This is the first of what I hope, Yemir Hashem, will be a three-part series as we prepare together for Pesach. Today we're going to be giving a halacha shir on all of the halachos of the Seder in general and specifically how they apply to women. And Yemir Hashem, next week we'll discuss cleaning and kashering. It was a dilemma, you know, how early is too early? Didn't want to wait till the last, you know, too late. So I figured 2 weeks before Pesach is a reasonable time to start that pleasurable process that we all look forward to of pre-Pesach cleaning. And then, Yemir Tzah Hashem, the week of Pesach, we won't have a shir. The week before Pesach, that final week, we will not have any shir. But that the last week of this series, which will be 2 weeks before Pesach, a little bit less, we will have a shir more on Machshava, on some of the, you know, meaning, in general, the meaning of Pesach, or maybe we'll do some Haggadah Divrei Torah. Why shouldn't the moms also be able to give Divrei Torah to Seder? So maybe we'll figure out something, but that'll be something more machshavti about the message and meaning of Pesach and the Seder. But today we speak about the mitzvahs of the Seder, and I guess as a slightly humorous or cute introduction, I'm reminded of an old Yiddish story. I think I first heard this from Rabbi J.J. Schachter. About how there was a couple, family that was sitting, by the Seder. Everyone was around the table and they were up to the, 10 makos and they're each dipping their fingers in and dam, svardeya. And then somebody notices, in the family that the babi, the matriarch of the family who was hosting the Seder with all the kids and the grandkids, she dipped 11 times. So he said, I thought it's only 10. Everyone knows. You know, she says, I know. As Bamir Erev Pesach is Oicher Maka. With all the work that women have to put in before Pesach, she was dipping for one other maka. So I'm sensitive as the only male in the room to the incredible Mesiras Nefesh that women often put in advance of the Seder and at the Seder itself. And therefore, it's out of that sensitivity and great respect and admiration for Nashim Tzidkaniyos throughout the generations. It's important to come into the Seder with a proper perspective and, frankly, with just simply enough energy, which sometimes women don't have. I've seen it. Just enough energy in order to be able to enjoy the Seder, have a Simchas Yom Tov, and also be able, of course, to fulfill the mitzvos of the Seder. And whether that has to do with budgeting one's time over the next few weeks so that you're not completely crazy at the last minute, or I strongly encourage getting help to clean the house and things like that. We'll discuss how crazy you have to be b'chlal to clean the house. That we'll discuss next week. But there are all sorts of wonderful services. In fact, someone told me that there's two fantastic young men. Oh yeah, they're my sons, right, who have a business cleaning. It's not only a good way to make them, you know, learn what it means about hard work. You're teaching them, you're doing them a favor. But if they can do you a favor and help make your preparation easier, I recommend them. And if Nebuch, they're too busy, so then I understand there are lots of other people and other people's kids who have similar businesses. But obviously, the Yaakov and Yosef team are the recommended ones, officially sponsoring today's shir. Okay. So I'd like to break down today's shir into the mitzvos of the Seder with the issue of reclining in general, and again, how that relates to women is kind of something that is, I wouldn't say it doesn't relate to the entire shir, but it relates to, obviously, a lot of the specific mitzvos we'll discuss. There are 7 mitzvos that we're obligated in at the Seder every year. 2 of them are midoraisa from the Torah, and 5 of them in our generation are rabbinic, are midrabanan. The 2 which are midoraisa, which we'll start off with first, are Sipra Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Haggadah, telling over the story, and Achilas Matzah. Those are both considered doraisa even nowadays. And the 5 that are midrabanan are the 4 cups, Moror, Halel, and things like that, which we also say throughout the Seder. Those are all considered derabanan, etc. Okay, so let's focus specifically on Sipra Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is, you know, maybe the essence of the entire Seder, and one of the important mitzvahs, d'oraisa. So the source of this, the Rambam and Sefer HaChinuch tell us, is based on the Pasuk in Shmos, in Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Ches, V'gadah Levincha, and the Saper, there's a mitzvah of Sipur. And what's interesting, and I'll just briefly get this, there's enough material in this one point we're about to make, even for a whole Shabbos HaGadol Drasha, but just to give a brief point, there's a very famous question, which is, what makes the mitzvah of Haggadah or Sipur unique? After all, there's a mitzvah to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim, Zecher, or Zechir Yetzias Mitzrayim, every day of the year. We do that in Shema, in morning and evening. That's a mitzvah d'oraisa. So what makes all of a sudden the mitzvah of Sipur, okay, the verb is different, to remember or to tell. The question is, what exactly does that mean? What makes this mitzvah different? And this has had a lot of discussion over the centuries. for whatever particular reason, I don't know, it has somehow gelled even more than usual around the Soloveitchik family and the Briskers. They have a disproportionate contribution to this question, even though other people have discussed it. And I think at 1 year I was able to collect 10 different answers to the question, or 10 different unique dimensions. We won't go all through 10, but just to highlight some of the main ones, which I think are salient for all of us as parents and as grandparents, to be very cognizant of at the Seder. And that is, number one, part of what makes Sipur unique at the Seder is that it has to be done derech she'ela v'tshuva. It's not something that we just think, and it's not even something that we just declare, but the whole framework of question and answer, which is really a bedrock of all education, but especially, we know it's a prominent element at the Seder, it's not merely educational, it's also, according to some, part of the definition of what makes Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim unique at the Seder night. In addition, as we know, we say this in the Haggadah, Masil Benus, we start off with the negative, the downside. We, you know, like a good story arc, for those who appreciate a good story. We don't whitewash the history. We start with the bad. So machloket in the Gemara between Rav and Shmuel, how far bad do we go? Does bad mean the slavery in Egypt? Or does bad mean all the way going back to Terach and Arami or Vidavi in the earlier parts of history? And if you remember from year to year, and if not, you'll get refreshed in a few weeks. In our Haggadah, we do both. We incorporate both. So we do the not only the long story of the Exodus, we do the long story of Jewish history in miniature form at the Haggadah. And that broader perspective of the historical experience, not just, you know, the highlights, you know, the trailer, but the whole story, if you will, not just the final chapter, but the whole story and the story arc, that's, according to some, very much part of the mitzvah. Others suggest that an additional factor is, again, not just the question and answer, but the fact that you're supposed to say to somebody else. In fact, the Gemara says, you can't imagine anything that would be so sad, but let's say someone was alone for the Seder, which for the most of Jewish history would be inconceivable, except for 2 years ago during Corona, when even then it was rare, but it did happen in some very tragic situations where people literally, I don't mean husband or wife, I mean sometimes there was a widower or a widow or single people who were literally alone. But in that, just to illustrate the point, thank God that that's very rare and hopefully should never be repeated, but the Gemara describes that we paskin that even someone who's by themselves should read the Haggadah in a question and answer format. It's not just a way of communicating with other people. The nature of the mitzvah is question and answer, and also the idea of telling it over. You're not reading it, you're telling it over even to yourself, as the case may be. And one final point I'll mention is the fact that all of the deeper reasons and extra meaning, please come on in, there are seats, the deeper meaning of the mitzvah is also part of this, what we would call the Tamei HaMitzvot, which we discussed with Pesach, Matzah, Maror, and all the embellishment of this, Kala Marba, Harizem Meshubach. Obviously none of that is something that we do on a daily basis, but that is something that is unique for the Seder night. So that's the basic contours of the first mitzvah of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. It's an interesting side point. Again, this could be almost its own shir, but you'll note, even though it is a mitzvah d'oraita to tell over the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim and the Haggadah, we don't make a bracha on that mitzvah. We make plenty of brachos at the Seder, on the Maror, on the Matzah. But we don't say, Asher Kedashanu B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu L'saper B'tziat Mitzrayim. You would have expected would be a bracha. It's one of the 613 mitzvos. It's a mitzvah d'oraita. So there's all sorts of discussions. Some of Farshim say, well, maybe some of the brachos that we say in the Haggadah anyway, like Asher Ga'alanu, maybe they count for the mitzvah. But I think that the more insightful and I think very meaningful, even on a spiritual level, answer is that, in fact, we don't say, we don't try to figure out some hidden way where we're technically alluding to the bracha. No, we have no bracha. And why not? So I think there's really two very profound insights which are relevant just to mention. One is the Maharal. Maharal says the reason there's no bracha on the mitzvah of the Haggadah, of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, is because even though we are saying all of these things, we have to realize that the essence of the mitzvah is that we should feel the experience of the Exodus, the feeling of the thrill, the exhilaration, the Hakaran HaTov. That feeling, which again, it's always important in all of Judaism and all of life, we don't want to just go through the motions. We want to connect on an emotional and deep existential or spiritual level. That is true in general, for sure. But it's especially true, says the Maharal, at the Seder. And since the essence of the mitzvah is something in the heart, says the Maharal, in general in Judaism, we don't make brachos on things where the real mitzvah is the heart, even if we have some physical expression of that. For example, we don't make a bracha, Shekhar Samas Vivanu, al bitul chametz. Even though we do the kol chamira, we have to mevatel chametz. None of us want to own chametz. But nevertheless, there's no bracha asher k'dasham sosaf. That has to do with things that we do with our limbs. And this is really a mitzvah of the heart. That's one I think, very important idea. A second idea, which many, many years ago, I remember reading for the first time, and it always struck me because I think it has applicability to a wide range of examples, and also because it was an ancestor of mine, which is the Sfat Emet, the famous Ger Rebbe. So he says the reason we don't make a bracha on this is because if you wanted to sum up the whole Haggadah, and this could be very important depending on the age of your children, or maybe, or no matter what your age of your children is. There's so many Divrei Torah and all sorts of other things, but you don't want to lose, you know, you want to make sure that you don't forget the main thing. And the main thing, says the Sfas Emes, if you had to summarize the whole Haggadah, Hakar Hatov. Gratitude to Hashem for what he did for us. Says the Sfas Emes, if you accept his assumption, he says, so in general, we don't have a bracha on things like Hakar Hatov. Right? We hopefully have Hakar Hatov in lots of areas of our life, and hopefully we're educating our children and grandchildren for that, 12 months a year, not just at the Seder. But nevertheless, why is there no bracha? So says the Sfas Emes, part of his overall theory, he says this in a number of areas, is mitzvot, which are so obviously intuitive and logical, don't have a bracha. We don't make a bracha on kibbutz avim. We don't make a bracha on doing chesed. We make a bracha on giving tzedakah. So there are different answers to all those questions. The Sfas Emes has one answer to all of them. He says, the mitzvot, which are so obviously and compellingly rational and intuitive, we don't make a bracha. Well, why not? Are we anti-rational? No, on the contrary. When we make a bracha, what are we saying? Asher kedeshanu b'mitzvotav vitzivanu. As if, he understands, we're basically saying we wouldn't do the mitzvah unless we were commanded. Right? Who would shake a lulav if you weren't commanded? Who would blow a shofar if you're not commanded? We would never dream on it. We're not saying it's irrational, but it's not something we would have caught up on our own. So the bracha is a declaration, so to speak, of faith. I am doing this because Hashem commanded. But wouldn't we have Hakar Hatov for our parents, even if we weren't commanded? Even if there was no mitzvah, wouldn't we have Hakar Hatov for Hashem giving us his freedom? Wouldn't we want to help poor people, even if we weren't commanded? So it says the Sfas Emes, we only make brachas on things which are not intuitive. So again, how much you want to elaborate on the broader theme at the Seder or other points, I think it's a very important lesson to give over to children and to think about ourselves, but especially in terms of framing what is the whole essence of the Haggadah, says Sfas Emes, you can boil it down to one phrase, Hakar Hatov, gratitude, and for him, that also explains why there is no bracha. Last but not least, before we move on to the next mitzvah, is the question of whether women are obligated in the mitzvah of the Haggadah of Yitziat Mitzrayim. So theme alert for the rest of this year, you are, like in everything at the Seder. And it's actually a very interesting halachic reality because, as we know, women are not always obligated in every positive mitzvah. In fact, someone will remember, it was 2 or 3 months ago, earlier in our series of Shirim this year, we did a two-part series on women in mitzvos and that broader point and why there are some mitzvos that women are not obligated in. And the classic category of mitzvah aseh shehazman grama, positive time-bound mitzvos, one would have thought would exempt women from the mitzvos of the Seder. Just like a woman's not obligated to sit in a sukkah, that has to be on the 15th of Tishrei. Well, this is on the 15th of Nisan. If it's on a calendar date, usually those kind of mitzvot women are exempt from. Again, we're not getting to the details now of why and all that that we discussed in the previous series. But it would seem ostensibly on its face a perfect candidate for women to be exempt from the mitzvot. And basically, each of the different mitzvot might have slightly different reasons, but the most common reason that explains many, including why women are obligated in the Haggadah, is based on the well-known principle of Af hein hayu ba'oso hanes. We saw this again in that series a few months ago, and most of you are probably familiar with the concept, which is that, says the Gemara, even when you have a mitzvah, which seems to be time-bound, but if it was a story in which women were just as beneficiaries of Hashem's great kindness as men, i.e., we were all going to get killed by the Egyptians, we were all enslaved, it wasn't good for anybody, men or women, or, according to other interpretations, women are the catalyst of the miracle. And in the case of Yitziat Mitzrayim, we have the famous Chazal of Bezchut Nashim Tzidkaniot, Negulu Avotenu. So whichever interpretation you have for that phrase, Pesach is a perfect example of that. So says that the Sefer HaChinuch and others, that women are obligated in Sipur Yitziat Mitzrayim based on the principle of Afein Hayub Osa Nes. Now, there is a little bit of wiggle room for women given the fact that it is this extra limud. And it is true, again, especially for women who may be hosting the Seder, that they can't always be at the table for everything. The truth is, depending on the feasibility and the makeup of your family, I would vote, if possible, if a woman needs to step out to go and put things up on the blech or whatever, so then wait. Why should she have to miss anything? Again, that's not always feasible with young kids or other things going on at the Seder, or if it's getting too late, people might want to, move along. I'm not micromanaging anyone's personal Seder. But my point is, if for whatever reason you have to be either, you have other preoccupations or other responsibilities, so just to be aware, minimally, certainly a woman has to be part of Kiddush. We'll get to the whole mitzvah of four cups later in the shiur. But a woman certainly is obligated in Kiddush. In some families, like in mine, we have a minhag that literally everyone, men, women, and child, we all sing Kiddush together. Or if you do it more like you do on a typical Friday night, either way. But women certainly are obligated in Kiddush. The first of the cups, as we'll see, women are obligated in all four cups. But also, basically, the crux of the... Of the story, basically, when we, as we know, as we say in the Haggadah, you know, anyone who doesn't say these three things, lo yotzu yedei chavasam, pesach, matzah, marer, so that section of Raman Gamliel, until we drink the second cup, that is absolutely critical for a woman to say. She definitely is obligated in that mitzvah, just like men. And Mirabanan also, as we'll see towards the end of the Shir, even Hallel, the end of the Seder. And of course, the Mishnah Berurah and others bring down that the Minog is, and it certainly would be important for as much as possible of the Seder, especially the Ten Makos and things like that. Certainly women should be part of the Seder. And you know, again, everyone's family has, you know, different Sedarim. You know, I remember when we got married, and I know it's true, many other people have told me the same thing. When we first get married, that first Yontif you go away, right? No one's Rosh Hashanah is exactly the same, and no one's Sukkos. And yet it doesn't really seem to matter. No one seems to mind going to their in-laws for other Yom Tovim. But the Seder, like, there's no two Sedarim that are same, and most people grow up loving their family Seder, and it's like the hardest thing ever to adapt to someone else's family Seder. So however your family Seder goes, you know, some are more participatory, different people read different things, whatever. We're not back in kindergarten, we're not gonna do model Seder now. But whatever that is, both on a spiritual, religious level, but also on a strictly halachic level, women should be as much, I think it's unquestionable that women should participate as much as possible, and everyone else at the table should be making sure to help that it is feasible for the women to be able to participate as much as possible. Okay, that's our first topic of today, Sipra Yetziyah Mitzrayim. The second mitzvah, which is a d'oraita mitzvah at the Seder, is matzah. Even nowadays, even without the Korban Pesach, matzah is its own independent mitzvah, and the Gemara tells us, because even though many times in the Chumash, matzah is linked to the Korban Pesach. That was kind of like the lafa that you would have the steak in. That's Korban Pesach, was a nice good lafa, shawarma. But the Gemara points out there's at least one time where the Pasuk says, Be'erev tochlu matzot. On that night, on the 15th of Nisan, you have to eat matzot, and that Pasuk makes no reference to the Korban Pesach, i.e. it's disconnected. There's an independent mitzvah, you have matzah, and even though we don't unfortunately have a Beis HaMikdash, we don't have a Korban Pesach, but matzah is considered midoraisa as an obligation, even nowadays. It's interesting, the Chasam Sofer just points out as an aside, it's really an amazing thing to appreciate, because we, you know, especially in Israel, we only get it one night a year. If you're in Chutz Laretz, you can get it twice, but Chasam Sofer points out, from the Torah's perspective, we went all the way back to the Chumash, there are a lot of foods, a lot of eating mitzvahs, that were d'oraisa, right? Truma and Meiser, things like that, mitzvot pluya pa'aretz, things like that. Even Shemitah nowadays, back in the beginning of the year, we spoke about the Shemitah nowadays is probably only d'rabanan. Other examples, eating a carbon, Meiser Sheni, all these things, you know, it wasn't just like a Catskills joke about Jews loving eating. Like, there were a lot of real mitzvot that related to food. None of them exist anymore, at least on a d'oraisa level. The only eating mitzvah we have d'oraisa all year round nowadays, says the Chasam Sofer, is eating matzah at the Seder. So it really is a big deal, and very, very important. The Gemara tells us, and of course all the Mefarshim Paskin like the Gemara, that women are obligated to eat matzah as well. And this is the one mitzvah in particular on the night of the Seder, which you're obligated in, but not because of Achein Hayi Boswa Neis. You're actually obligated even more, so to speak, than that. Why? So the Gemara, something very interesting. And again, this is something just to keep in mind throughout the year, or even on Pesach, especially if you're looking at the Pesukim and the Chumash, you know, the Torah gives a lot of attention in various places to the story of Yetziyat Mitzrayim, and also to the mitzvos of matzah and chametz and all these related Pesach topics. And the Gemara points out in a number of places, often unforced from a pshat perspective, almost sometimes even non sequiturs, the Chumash often lumps together matzah and chametz. A chametz pasuk will all of a sudden throw in matzah, and a matzah pasuk will always automatically throw in, unnecessarily seemingly throw in matzah, and vice versa. So says the Gemara, what do you see from this? That the two mitzvos are inextricably linked. I think I said this in a Shabbos of God or Joshua 2 years ago, what I like to use, you know, coin the phrase, that, you know, chametz is matzah's evil twin brother. it's something that could, you know, it could have been, and he just waited that extra minute too long. It's the right, they're like mirror images of themselves. It's the Yaakov and Esav, but they're twins. Just one's the good one, one's the bad one. So there are numerous ramifications of that. One of the ramifications, says the Gemara, is anyone who's prohibited from eating chametz, by definition, is also obligated to eat matzah. You cannot have a Jew who would be obligated in only one of the others. They go together. They're a team. And therefore, since women are prohibited from eating chametz, just like men are, so it must be, that women are also obligated, mi'ikar hadin, in eating matzah as well. So your chiyuv of eating matzah is no less than any of the men in your family as well. And that's a very important point to keep in mind. Now this relationship, I won't dwell on this too much, because I don't think it's necessary for a shir like ours, but just to point out, this relationship, if you will, kind of giving you a new way of thinking about it, this relationship, the sibling rivalry between matzah and chametz, has other ramifications as well, including what ingredients matzah can come from. Says the Gemara, based on the same idea in the Psukim of this kind of interconnection between matzah and chametz, the only ingredients that you can use and make matzah out of are ingredients that, if you would have waited a little too long, would become chametz. Right? But you can't have, just as an example, you can't have potato flour matzah, since I know they can make potato flour pancakes and waffles. And last night I was at a wedding, and they were serving, you know, shredded steak sandwiches, which you didn't have to wash for, you didn't have to make a mazonas for, in potato flour rolls. You know, so they were getting ready already. You know, this is like the newest wedding shtick. Yeah, just in case you're wondering, it's a thing you can do, and you should. As a guest, we appreciate that. I can tell you, I had two. And I would have had more, but they cleaned it, they took it away. Anyway, you can't have a potato flour matzah, because potato flour, no matter how long you let it rise, no matter how long you wait while you're kneading it, it wouldn't matter. Potato flour can't become chametz. Only the big five grains can become chametz, and only therefore the product of the big five grains can become matzah. And just to review, what are the big five grains? Of course, wheat, spelt, barley, oats, and rye. Any of those, in theory, could become chametz, so we want to stay away from that. But if you had matzah made out of any of those, that would be should be kosher for Pesach. Similarly, another question, the other factor in the ingredient, of course, is what is the liquid binding agent that you're using. So really, you should just use water. Matzah should just be flour and water. And in fact, if you would add other juices to it, it could be problematic on a number of fronts. And these other juices, you might think, well, who would ever do such a thing? You may not realize it, but what we colloquially refer to as egg matzah is exactly that. And egg matzah is a cover-all phrase for fruit juices, eggs, all sorts of other things. White wine, Manischewitz, I think, or other companies sometimes use and make. So why they would use it, why they make it, even nowadays, those products, is because certain people, especially older people, can't digest good old-fashioned matzah. I think the rest of us also could empathize, even if we can do it. You know, it takes a little extra koyach to do the entire process. We don't need to get into the details. But certain people, it's easier to go down. It's a softer digestive product. And the truth is, for older or for sick people, yeah, you should definitely speak to a rabbi before using it at the Seder. But there are allowances for people who need to use this kind of egg matzah, or what's known as matzah ashira. But there's two possible problems, which is why the rest of us should thank God for our good health and not go anywhere near it. Certainly not at the Seder, but really in general. So at the Seder, the problem is that we know, as we say in the Haggadah, that matzah is lechem oni, poor man's bread. So you start adding these other quote-unquote fancy juices, it's not so poor anymore. That's one point. That's a particular problem at the Seder. In general, throughout the holiday, it's still an issue because the Gemara and the Rishonim are very nervous, and we're not really sure if we can pin down exactly, but they assumed, based on their knowledge of the science or the chemistry of the day, that when you add the fruit juices, it catalyzes the whole fermentation process, the chemos process, much faster. So this whole idea, which we're not going to get into how they figure this out, but this idea that which we've grown up with about 18 minutes, and you need to finish the matzah within 18 minutes, which is like chametz, that's true if it's water. But once you add the other juices, we assume that the process goes faster. We're not sure how fast. We don't want to get into it. So you have a suffix chametz, which is bad. You don't have poor man's bread. It's also a problem. So we, as a general rule, avoid that. Our matzahs are all just, you know, the flour of those five grains and water. Okay, that's the ingredient. Then there's this other thing which we should be aware of. Again, you've heard the phrase. You may all know the background, but just in case, we'll be a little bit more intelligent and knowledgeable this year. And that is shmura matzah. What does that mean, shmura matzah? and what is machine versus hand, and is that only for the Seder? Do I have to have Shmur Matzah all Pesach? So let's see if we can fill in the background of those important questions for just a few minutes. So the Pasuk says, Ushmartem es ha-matos. So that's where the phrase comes from. But what was the Torah telling us? So this simple question is actually a huge machloket, probably between two of the greatest of the greats, Rashi and the Rambam. The Rambam seems to say that this just means you have to really, really, really be super duper careful to make sure it doesn't become chametz. Okay, I mean, we don't say ushmartem that you don't by accident buy chazer, ushmartem that by accident you don't. In general, we know that the mitzvah is stay away from certain foods, and it doesn't say ushmartem not to be milk and meat, because obviously we don't want to do it. But says the Rambam, but chametz is much more severe. If you would eat chametz on Pesach, God forbid. That's a capital offense in Isser Kares. So the Torah says, ushmartem, be super duper careful. Okay, it's a possibility. Rashi says, no. Obviously, we have to be careful. I don't need the Torah to tell me that. Again, every now and then, you see people and you wonder, I think normal people, when you're in these really dangerous places or these high buildings, the warning, you think, who needs the sign? Who would go close? And then you read about someone who fell off a cliff taking a selfie, and you're like, yeah, people do need these signs. So Barashi basically says, you wouldn't need a sign to say, be careful. It's chametz. Of course we're going to be careful. When the Torah says ushmartem, it meant that when we bake the matzah, when we prepare the matzah, we have to have special kavana. We have to be infusing. It's not just enough to be baking in 18 minutesing. I made that word up, 18 minutesing. Someone can copyright it. Maybe we can make some money for the shul on that. A t-shirt, swag, we'll do merch, we'll do all the things. 18 minutesing. Anyway, you should just know, by the way, there is a Leva Torah has an oven. And I think they signed up. There was a chabura. I think in previous years there were women who signed up for a chabura to do matzah baking. But I know that the men in the shul had to sign up people make their own matzahs down at Leva Torah. So maybe for them we should do your shul merch, 18 minutes in or something like that. And I think it might be too late for this year, but next year someone make a note of that. That could be a good fundraiser for the shul. So says Rashi, it's more than that. While you're doing that, you have to basically articulate, I'm doing this for the mitzvah. And in fact, if anyone's ever been at a bakery where they saw people baking matzahs or they did it themselves, which I've done, I think, once or twice, you're always saying at every stage, L'shem mitzvahs matzah. L'shem mitzvahs. You want to articulate to make sure that there's kavana for it. And we try, as a general rule, when it comes to the Seder, we try to be machmir for both opinions. We have extra special guarding of the matzah to make sure it doesn't become chametz. And also we assume, if we get the right, we buy from the right hashkacha, or when we do it ourselves, we do try to keep Rashi's view of imbuing the process, every stage of that process, with this extra explicit type of kavana. And we all know, what does that mean, the process, right? To take anything, if we ever think about it, how does it get from the, how does wheat or whatever get from the field, into our kitchen? A lot of things had to happen in the interim. So there's the harvesting, the katsira, right? It's just grain. Then there's the tchina, grinding it into flour. Then there's the lisha, mixing it with the flour and the water. Then there's the afia. And there's a big machloka. Again, this would be a whole shir in itself if we wanted, about when does the shimur, this extra guarding or the kavana, when does that have to start? Our minhag is, when this is also a theme alert when it comes to Pesach, we're machmir, right? Even more than we would be for most things during the year, we endorse a little bit of healthy neurosis when it comes to Pesach. It's one of the areas, we don't do that for every area of halacha, but this is one of the areas of halacha. Again, once you endorse a little bit of healthy neurosis, it's not a surprise that some people start cleaning their floors with toothbrushes, which we will tell you next week you don't have to do, but you don't have to wait till next week. You don't have to do that. Okay, we'll get into more of the details of the cleaning and the koshering. That's next week's year. But the point is, once you allow a little healthy neurosis, it's obviously going to spread. But we do endorse a little healthy neurosis. We are a machmir, so therefore we generally say, and you'll see this, again, you might not have ever even thought to look, but just pay attention this year when you bring home the matzahs, whether you buy them or your husband buys them, whoever brings home the matzahs, usually it'll say, shamor or shimor mishas ktsira. Right, that you'll see that pretty much that's industry standard nowadays. That's the earliest stage, so it's not even flour yet, let alone mixed with water. It couldn't have become chametz. Nevertheless, we are very, very careful at every stage, even the earliest stage of the harvesting. Really, 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 this level of super duper matzah is really only obligatory at the Seder, because the Seder is where there's an obligation to eat matzah. So we want our mitzvahs matzah, our matzah mitzvahs, to be super duper kadosh and careful. Nevertheless, the poskim recommend, and it's widely, in our modern economy, it's easy and it's accessible, and I think this is the common minhag, we do try throughout the rest of the Chag, when we're just having our matzah butter and jam or whatever else we might be doing, matzah brei for those who eat kebrach, or other such things. And if not, too bad for you. In case you wonder what my family minhag is, we definitely eat kebrach. You know, we try to use shmur matzah throughout the Pesach. But mi'ikar adin, if you had matzah that was again certified, you know, that it was kosher for Pesach, because we don't mess around with chametz even if it's not the Seder. In theory, even if it wasn't shmur matzah, you know, from some early stage, you could eat that other than the Seder. But I think it's a good hitter to try to only eat shmur matzah if you can throughout the whole week of Pesach. What about machine versus hand? Just as you know, that's again, I'm not sure if I did it in this shul, but I haven't. Previous stages of my career, given an entire Shabbos, like a little drasher on that topic. That's its own fascinating historical and halachic topic. What's the history of machine matzah? It used to be very controversial. Now it's much more accepted. Ad kerikach, there are certain communities, including they say Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who felt the machine was even better than hand. Right? That's not the typical. Like I can tell you, the typical mentality of Yidden is, you know, we get very traditional when it comes to our mitzvos. And a lot of people, you know, want hand. Again, that's also how I grew up. But you should know that, for all intents and purposes, I'm just, you know, being very simplistic for the moment and skipping all the details. There are different minhagim, and as long as you're getting it from a good bakery or with the proper hashkacha, I don't think there's any reason to think from a strictly halachic perspective that one is better than the other. As I say, there are great poskim who prefer hand, there are great poskim who have preferred even machine, and whatever your family minhag is certainly from my perspective, would be fine. And there are those, like, for example, in my family, you know, again, I can't imagine ever that we would have used machine matzah at the Seder, but we use it the rest of the Chag, unless we have leftovers, because at least when my Zaidi, Alav HaShalom, was alive, he bought enough matzah to last at least until Shavuos. So we certainly had enough for the rest of the Chag. We didn't need to mess around with machine. We have a little less, but I certainly would eat machine, again, but my family minhag is I definitely eat hand at the Seder, but there are those who don't, and whatever your minhag is would be fine. Yeah, Alyssa?
I was going to say, according to Rashi,
so that's sure which I but the short answer to your question is in the factory when they're pushing the button, the mashgiach or the woman, whoever is making, and maybe the mashgiach is a woman, that's a different question, but whoever is the mashgiach, that's not our topic today, whoever is pushing that button, they say l'shem mitzvah matzah, and part of the objection to machine matzah was, is that effective? Can you imbue the l'shma, the l'shem mitzvah matzah, to a machine, an automated process? Again, it's a fascinating topic. Not for today, but if you do machine matzah, they're doing the lishma too, and they just believe that works. And other people were less convinced. Okay, last but not least, everyone's least favorite topic, which is how much matzah do you have to eat? At least in my family, I'm always fighting with my kids, even maybe other people aren't my kids, of how much matzah that they have to. I just said somebody. A lot of people aren't my kids at the same Seder as me. I didn't say anything about anything. Okay, I'm gonna be walking home. I mean. So most mitzvahs we have that relate to food in Judaism, the shear is a kazayit, right? We know that they didn't have, you know, fancy measuring things in the time of Chazal. They use metaphors like an olive, like an egg, like a dried date, fig, whatever. We have different, so the standard one we know is what we call a kazayit. So there's simplifying books worth of material now for a few minutes. Huge debates to try to figure out what exactly is an olive. And then we say, well, some people say an olive is really a half of an egg. The Rambam said that an olive is a third of an egg. We generally try to be machmir that it would be the volume of what would be the equivalent of a half of an egg. Okay, Shkach, how does that help me? What's the volume of a half an egg? So this is a huge tumult and basically a huge thing which happened, you know, 200 plus years ago in the time of the Noda B'Yehuda, the famed Rav of Prague, Rabbi Cheska Lando. He did a whole complicated cheshbon and he was convinced that our eggs are smaller than the egg in the time of the Gemara. And therefore we have to double whatever they used to think. Now we have to double the size. So do we have to be so strict like the Noda B'Yehuda and double the amount that we're eating? Usually throughout the year, we're not as strict. But when it comes to the Seder, especially for the mitzvahs d'oraisa, and as I mentioned, matzah is d'oraisa, and men and women, we're all obligated in it. So we take the strict approach that we try to, you know, have basically what would be two kazesim, because maybe the Noda B'Yehuda is right, that ours are smaller than they used to be in the time of the Gemara. So what does that mean, bottom line? So basically, again, there's like so many different shitos out there. I can't do justice to all of them. But I would say as a rough estimate, if you take a look, for example, like I was looking last night just to review as a classic English book for Americans. I looked at Rabbi Eider's famous book, and in Israel I looked at Rabbi Rimon's. And basically it would come out that, let's say for a hand matzah, you know, which are different shapes, usually they're bigger than the machine matzah pieces. A hand would probably be about a half of a matzah, would be enough for the mitzvah. That means for each person, a half of a whole matzah. And if you're using machine, probably two-thirds of a piece. And so before I forget, that is for motzi matzah, right? And it's also for afikomen. Even though afikomen is probably only derabana nowadays, but for many, some mafarshim think that the afikomen is really the main mitzvah of matzah. And that's, again, it's its own shir. Really, we need its own Shabbos HaGadol Rasha about what is afikomen. But some think that it's zecher, the meat of the Korban Pesach. But others say, no, it's actually the real main mitzvah of the matzah, because it's the matzah that was eaten with the Korban Pesach. And therefore, we try to be strict on afikomen as well, of the larger shir, which would be, as a half of a hand or two-thirds of a machine. Korech, which is a minhug, zech lemikdash, you know, kehillel, kenasa hillel, so that's a minhug, so there we're more mekil in terms of the amount of matzah to eat, and there I would say only a quarter of a hand would be enough. You could have, you know, I would say half of what the first one was. And in machine, it would be one-third instead of two-thirds. Okay, so that's basically the idea. Also, again, one more technical point, and then we're going to move on to all the other mitzvos, is in general, this is true about eating. Some of you may remember this in the reverse. On Yom Kippur, if you ever had a heter to eat on Yom Kippur, if you were pregnant or you were sick or something like that. So we know that in Judaism, there's always, in halacha, there's always two factors. One is how much you're eating, but then there's the time. Right? If you eat very, very slowly, you could eat an enormous amount, but from a halachic perspective, that would be almost meaningless because you didn't eat it in a certain amount of time to make it all cohesively into one act of eating. So in the mitzvah sense, where we're trying to eat it as quickly as possible, so it's not just how much matzah we eat, it's supposed to be with a little bit of alacrity. So how much time, also huge machloksim, just like as you may recall, certainly anybody who over the years has asked me for shilas, for example, on Yom Kippur, I always tell them there's a range, and I always tell them you should start being machmir, and I usually tell them 9 minutes. That's the standard that we tell people, let's say on Yom Kippur, so have a little bit of like a shot glass of juice or water, whatever the case may be, and then wait 9 minutes and then do it again. Wait, because that's one of the standard shurim. When it comes to things like people who aren't feeling well on Yom Kippur, we always tell them, but if you see that's not helping, then you can decrease the interval, right? The machloket range is somewhere from 2 minutes to 9 minutes, okay? So when it comes to matzah, especially for the main mitzvah, achilat matzah, if you really want to do it muhudar, muhudar, so then you're having that double kezayis in about 2 minutes, right? Which certainly leaves you not that much room to talk. Right. If you're also talking, you're definitely not eating it enough or fast enough. That's for sure. Okay. It's not, if you need to take a little bit more time, I would say, if you ask me, better to eat the right amount of matzah in 4 or 5 minutes than have 3 bites in 2 minutes. That's, you really do need to eat a minimum amount of matzah. But, you know, again, if it sounds crazy to you and difficult, and maybe over the years is something you've struggled with, just ask yourself, would you be happy? I'm not talking about if you had to just go to like a second shofar blowing or something and you had little kids. But in general, when you showed up in shul, would you leave in the middle of shofar blowing and say, oh, I heard 30, it's enough. I heard 27, it's enough. Right? You want to do the mitzvah the right way. The right way is 100. This is even more important than that, because you really are yotzei with less than 100 shofar blasts. You're not yotzei with less than the amount of matzah. It's really an important point. And there is a range of views. If a person really was eating so slowly, you probably have up to 18 minutes. Because it's a double kazayas, so it's 9 times 2. But somewhere in between 2 and 18, find what works for you and your digestive system. You don't want to overeat, you don't want to become a chazer, for sure not. But you really should try to be makbid on this. This is an important mitzvah. Okay, we used up a lot of the time on the first two mitzvahs, but that was on purpose, because those are the two mitzvahs daraisa. These are the two most important mitzvahs of the Seder, are Sibrit Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Haggadah, and matzah. Now let's try to run through a few of the other derabbanan mitzvos, as well as we'll discuss the issue of leaning as we go through them as well. Because leaning will relate to matzah, so we'll come back to that. So the next big mitzvah we want to talk about, of course, is the 4 cups. And this is brought already down in the Mishnah and in the Gemara. And the idea seems to be that this is a general way of cheirus. It shows our freedom and the fact that we're celebrating our liberation. And we know that many of the Mefarshim, like Rashi and Rashbam, say that the reason we have 4 cups is because of the Arba Lashonos of Geula. Moshe tells the Jewish people how Hashem's going to liberate them. He uses 4 different phrases, V'hotzeiti, V'hitzalti, V'ga'alti, V'lakachti. So because of those 4 phrases, so we have 4 different cups. There's different Mefarshim discuss, which I don't want to waste the time on now, even though it is interesting. Why wine? Maybe we should have 4 something else's. Why is it Dafka 4 cups of wine? Okay, that's an interesting question, but I don't want to spend the time on it now. But we do have four cups of wine based on, there's different theories, but the most popular reason being the Arba Lashonos of Geula. When do we drink the four cups? So this is important. The Gemara says it's not a random thing. They have to be, each one has to be drunk at the right time, al haseder, attached to a particular mitzvah. So the first cup, when do we drink? That's part of Kiddush. The second cup, we, as we mentioned before, is the Magid, the body of the storytelling. The third is benching, and the fourth is Hallel. You know, that's the hardest one for all of us. We're physically exhausted, another cup of wine, you know, another great, it's like we're losing our mind of it already, we're exhausted. But those are the four, and that's when they have you. Someone might think, I'll, you know, during the meal, I'll just have an extra cup, and then I don't have to stay up for Hallel. Don't worry about it. And the answer is that does not work. They have to be done at the right time during the Seder. How much do you have to drink? This is very, very important, especially because very often people do not have like their regular Kiddush cups. Very often they're using whatever their glass cup would be anyway, and oftentimes they're huge. I mean, the amount of ounces that are included in, if you go to a hotel, some of those cups, or even a lot of the standard cups that people buy for Pesach, they're actually way more than you would need. So how much do you really need? It's like pretty much all the other mitzvahs we have of Kiddush or other things during the year. We have a Revius, you know, and then you're supposed to drink at least a majority of that. So what does that translate into? So since I'm still American, I think in terms of ounces, but you could probably look all this stuff up or easily do the conversion in terms of like fluid liters or whatever they use and milliliters or whatever it is. I don't know. Whatever the, you know, I'm very American. I don't know what these Canadians or other Europeans pretend with other metric systems. So in terms of ounces, there's a big machloket. There is the Chazon Ish and the Moshe Feinstein. There's different, opinions as to how to translate this stuff into our modern day measurements. But it's somewhere in between 3.3 and a little over 5 ounces, which is actually a lot less than you would think. It's not huge. Even the 5 ounces is not a huge amount. Just think about a 12-ounce can of soda, right? So it's less than half of that, even according to the most machmer shita. Okay? So if you have a cup that's more or less that, so you have to drink a majority of that. You don't have to drink all of that. You have to drink a majority of that. Again, a sip, which I've seen many a time, is not the mitzvah. The mitzvah is you have to drink a majority of that. Now, according to most poskim, and this is what I would say is the bottom line, it doesn't matter how big the cup is. If you can roughly, again, it's easier to have a cup if you knew in advance was basically the 5 ounces. So that's easy. You could, with the naked eye, you could tell if you did a majority of the cup or not. If you have one of these huge cups, so you're more guesstimating, did I drink 2.5 ounces? Did I drink, the minimum amount? But probably, no matter how big your cup is, you still only need to drink a majority of a revius. I am letting you know, again, for those who want to be particularly machmir, or you have a family member who's been very machmir and you just think they're being crazy, they're not being crazy. There is another opinion out there of the Ramban. The Ramban says that a special halacha when it comes to the Seder is you have to drink a majority of the cup, no matter how big the cup is. So if you have these super cups, then either you're going to get drunk, basically, after one or two cups, or you're just not going to keep that Ramban. I don't think a person has to be machmer for that Ramban, but it is brought down in Shulchan Aruch, it is a hitter, and therefore, personally, if I was the one buying the cups, I would personally recommend don't buy a bigger cup, so that way you can still only drink a majority and not worry about the Ramban. Even if you did have a bigger cup, or you're going to your in-laws, you're going to a hotel, and there is a bigger cup, I don't think you have to make yourself crazy, because I don't think you have to be machmir for this Ramban. You should just be aware it's out there, and a lot of people are machmir for this. The Aruch HaShulchan brings it down, others bring it down as well. Women are obligated in the four cups, again, based on the idea of Afhein Hoyib Osanes, as we mentioned. What do you have to drink for Afhein? So the Gemara says there's an inyan of using red, different reasons for that, but one of the reasons, which is most popular, is because of the connection to the blood, and unfortunately the pain of the Jewish people and what the midstream did to the babies, etc. The Gemara also says that you need not just have the color, meaning red, but you also need to have tam yayin, which the Rashbam says means alcoholic. Now the reason this is important is because this is the grape juice question. Right? Any type of red wine, for the most part that's alcoholic, is sufficient. What about grape juice? So again, this is a whole shir in and of itself, but the bottom line is we know that throughout the year for Kiddush, many people use grape juice and pretty much no one argues on that. What about for the four cups? So this is a massive machloket among modern day poskim. There were poskim, I would say most prominently, but not exclusively, was Moshe Feinstein, who felt you could not use grape juice at the Seder because of this idea of the Rashbam and others that Cheirus, right? Alcoholic beverage is considered more luxurious, more chashuv. I happen to not be an alcohol person, but I'm aware that I'm probably the minority of the human race. So a lot of people appreciate alcohol, hopefully responsibly, but people do appreciate it. And that's considered more chashiv, the alcohol. So the Ramoshi and others felt that even if Kiddush throughout the year, you could use grape juice, but you shouldn't use grape juice for any of the four cups. There's a middle view that says, well, better you should use wine, maybe at least for the first cup, or have a little bit of wine and add it to the grape juice, or something that you can at least taste a little alcohol. But if you don't, if you're really, 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 really not going to like it, I don't mean a little bit, like really, really not going to like it, okay, you can use the grape juice. And then there's a third view, which among others, and he's not the only one, but among others, is brought down in the name of Rav Soloveitchik, who felt that if one truly will enjoy grape juice better, it's not like, okay, b'dieved will let you. It's actually better to use grape juice because it's not just, you know, there's one way to show I'm free is I can drink an alcoholic drink, but drinking something you don't like doesn't sound like a free man either. Right, it's more derech cheres to drink what you like, and if you really, really do like grape juice better, then Rav Soloveitchik is quoted by Rav Schechter and others as saying that he thinks that grape juice might even be lechachila. So, if you ask me, bottom line, I think anyone who reasonably enjoys wine is definitely would be better to drink wine. I think even Rav Soloveitchik would probably have said that. But there are many people who really, really don't enjoy wine, and certainly as you get into cups 2, 3, and 4, a lot of people lose the taste of wine. Again, some people increase their taste of wine, but. Others, I can relate to the people who lose their taste of wine as the night goes on. So I personally think that there's nothing wrong at all, and maybe even lechachila for those people to use grape juice. When I was a kid, the thing I looked forward to all year was we had sparkling Kedem grape juice at the Seder. You know, anything with fizz makes a kid happy, and I haven't lost the taste for that. It's still like my favorite thing. And then they made up this thing called wine with fizz for people like me, 7% alcohol, very little, you know. So I happen to personally even prefer the white version of that, but not the Seder. At the Seder, you can have the, so there's the, whatever I'm drinking is going to have bubbles. I can tell you that right now, hopefully. Either it's going to be the wine with the bubbles or the grape juice with the bubbles, because that's my derech eres. So I think that, you know, a person should do whatever is their derech eres. Again, if a person wants to be machmir for Rav Moshe and even drink wine if they don't like it, that's what Rav Moshe would tell you to do. I think, you know, again, I sometimes try out to have wine, let's say, for the first cup, but at some point I know I'm gonna stop enjoying even the bubbly wine, and then I'll personally have no problem switching to grape juice. And, you know, depending on what your family minhag is, I think that that's very, very, very reasonable. Okay. Yeah, please, of course.
Two things. How do we feel about, like people who are over bar mitzvah? In terms of the wine, like, was there anything?
No, again, from a strictly halacha perspective, everything I said is equally equivalent to them as it is to you. In your chinuch, you know, I'm happy to discuss with that privately, but if that was a personal decision. If you want my advice, I'm happy to give it to you on a case-by-case basis. But that's a parenting chinuch decision. If you think that, you know, in the context of a Seder with your parents and your grandparents or whatever, that's an appropriate way for a child to have wine, or if, you know, and I can see many parents feeling that way, and other parents saying, no, I don't want my children to have wine even for that.
Right.
I'm not going to make a statement on that to the whole group.
Okay,
but halakhically, it's no different than you or me.
Right. So there's a basis for mixing? Like,
yes, absolutely.
Mix.
Absolutely. Again, I think... Again, there are people who really think you need to have wine, and they want to make sure there's going to be a taste, and you're going to feel the wine. But too much wine is too much. Then they add some... I'm not sure you're gaining much if you have 85, 90% grape juice and you put a little wine in. I'm not sure that does much, because the people who think you need to have wine really feel you need to be able to taste and feel a little bit of the wine. But there's no question, if you're not a wine drinker, you know, a 50-50 combination or a 60-40 combination is a lot more tolerable than all wine if you really don't like wine. Yeah.
What's the Friday night amount?
So Friday night, that's a good question. So Friday night, we generally, again, the amount of the ounces, we would try to be machmir for the bigger shear. But again, that's just because Kiddush on Friday night might have an extra, if Yontav, again, that's, you know, this year it actually comes out on Friday night. So some people try to be a little bit more machmir.
5 ounces.
Yes, again, I would try, again, if you can't, you can't, but you should try, again, if 5 ounces is much less than you think, when you think of a cup. Most of our cups are probably that anyway. What is the standard cup you buy? I don't even know, 6, 7? I think I'm saying, so we're talking about something less than that. Again, if you, now some people have the minhag of they kosher their Kiddush cups from out the year. So those you have to really make sure, again, they're probably bigger enough anyway, but you want to just double check that. Yeah, please, yeah.
I always wondered, like, in terms of bracha korona, why we don't make bracha korona in between the.
Yeah, it's a.
And why we make a new bracha
each time. All good questions, which they're reasonable, but I'm going to run out of time if I answer them, okay? I apologize. Okay, question just for those listening on the recording or on the Zoom who didn't hear was, why do we make 4 different brachos? Usually one bracha is enough to drink, you know, the same thing different times. And because of, and paradoxically, even though we make new brachos, we don't make new brachronas. It's a very interesting discussion, but not for now. Okay, quickly, we're going to try to run through three more things. Leaning, Maror, and Hallel. Those are the other mitzvahs we haven't gotten to yet. So when it comes to leaning is a very, very fascinating topic, again, brought down already in the Mishnah and others, and it seems like, at least the way the Rambam understands the Mishnah, that we lean as an expression of Chayev Adam Liros Es Atzmo Kilhu Yatzmi Mitzrayim. It's a way of demonstrating our freedom, because at least back in the day, that's how, you know, kings and queens and free people used to eat, was they would be reclining, I guess is maybe the better word, than leaning. There's an interesting, you know, linguistic issue, which may actually be profound. Usually we say chayav adam liros as atmo, a person has to see him or see herself as if they went out of Mitzrayim. Imagine you were there. The Rambam actually says the mitzvah is chayav laharos, to demonstrate. So I always think of that as like Colonial Williamsburg, you know, when they dress up, you know, and you act, not that you actually feel it. Who could feel it? Yeah, I'm living in 2022. But you're supposed to act as if. And there may be a lot of interesting ramifications to those different interpretations, but that's the basic idea, and therefore we lean, because back in the day they used to lean. It's interesting, there was one opinion in the Rishonim, the opinion of the Rav Yah, who says something which, out of context, sounds like a non-Orthodox rabbi, you'll forgive me. But he says, it's not historically relevant anymore. Which is usually like not the way Orthodox rabbis think. Right, it was true then, but it's not true. Says the Rav Yah, they leaned because then that was a meaningful thing. No one leans now. You know, if you got invited to the White House and all of a sudden you wanted to show your great Amos HaKavod for the White House, you started leaning, right? Either they would throw you out or they would arrest you, but or look funny at you. You wouldn't think, oh, look how much Kavod he's showing to the president, right? Fancy bone china, you know, find out what the queen does, you know, how many plates, how many forks. That's what Cheres means nowadays, what it means to be a Melech or a Malka. It doesn't mean lean. So the Rav Yah says, yeah, it's not relevant anymore. Really shocking, but that's what the Rav Yah says. So not surprising, all the other Rishonim disagree with him. And in Shulchan Aruch, we basically bring down that even though it makes sense what the Rav Yah said, but we still machmir, as we all know from the way we've grown up our whole lives, that we still lean. But the fact that there's this Rav Yah out there may have ramifications, and it's important to be aware of, which I'll get to in a moment. How do you lean? So first of all, it's important to know, especially, for example, if you're in a chair like this, it doesn't have an armrest, you have a challenge. Because some people think that if they're the Leaning Tower of Pisa, they're fulfilling the mitzvah. They just go like this. Now, that is less comfortable than anything you could possibly imagine. And halachically, that is not called reclining. To recline means you're reclining on something. So if you have an armrest, that's the easiest. Or the corner of the table, that's also fine. Putting your arm on the table and leaning up against that. If you have a pillow that could give you some kind of support, although without an armrest, it probably won't. It's more just like a figment of something. But you need to lean on something. That's number one. Number two is we lean to the left. The Gemara says there's two reasons to lean to the left. One is we assume most people are righties, so you need to have your right hand free. If you're leaning on your left arm, you need the right hand free to feed yourself. And we're worried about the food pipe and the windpipe confusing, and if you lean this way, maybe chas v'shalom, the food will go down the wrong pipe. And this is not just an academic question in the post-game ask, but what about a lefty? I'm a lefty. What about lefties? So if it's just about your free hand, then lefties should lean to the right, so they have their left hand free. But the post-game say, no, chamira sakanta me'isura. Again, even though post can point out now, leaning to the right, it was not dangerous. It was probably a mistake from a scientific perspective. I've heard many people make that point. I've seen it. It's brought down as far. It doesn't really seem to be true. Nevertheless, that is the not only the minhag, that is the halacha. Everyone, righties and lefties, leans to the left because of this. When do we lean? So the answer is we lean at the appropriate parts that are kind of more celebratory. We lean for all four cups. We lean for matzah. We lean for korech because of the matzah. But we do not lean for something like maror. So that's the opposite of the cherus. Interesting question why we don't lean for karpas. Right, because we're dipping. The dipping is considered also some kind of a luxurious thing. Rav David Feinstein brings down, he thinks we should probably be leaning for karpas. He doesn't understand why not, but no one does it. So if you happen to have the family minhag, you know someone who does it, it may be that it's really the right thing to do. I'm not even sure, but I've never done it. I've never seen anyone do it, but it's just a curiosity why we don't lean for karpas, but I don't think that is the common minhag. And last but not least on the leaning thing is, well, who leans? So this is actually, there are a lot of different categories that are discussed in the Gemara, but the most relevant for us is, do women lean or not? And it's a very fascinating, the Gemara. The Gemara says, in Pesachim, Isha Eitz Al Baila, a married woman who's having Seder with her husband, she does not have to lean, but an Isha Chashuva has to lean. An important woman has to lean. Now, okay, it's a very nice language. What is that? How do you, if beauty is the eye in the beholder, is importance in the eye of the beholder? How do you define important? It's not clear at all from the Gemara. And there's actually a number of different interpretations of what exactly is going on in the Gemara. So the Rashbam basically seems to imply that it may relate to the dynamic of the marriage. Rashbam says that maybe typically, emas bala ukfufa lo. Maybe the marriage is not necessarily considered one of equals, and maybe she feels a little bit subservient to her husband. Therefore, she's not going to really feel so free. It's kind of a fake out for her to pretend when she's not. But in Isha Chashuva, but there could be other marriages where a woman does feel that way. It sounds like it's a very subjective thing, or maybe he's referring to someone who's dafka single and not married, who's independent. That's actually other some of Farshim say, yes, it's dafka specifically referring to single women, whether they're never were married or divorced or widowed, so then they would lean. That's one interpretation. Some interpretations are different. The Shiltot and others say, it's just not the way of women. It's not. He might mean it's not sanua. It's not clear what he means, but he basically just says it wasn't the minhag. Like women didn't lean. You know, if this is all about what did they did in the olden days and what did the evidently he suggests that the Gemara was saying mostly kings would lean, but not necessarily queens. But if you're in a place where women do lean, if that's what's called Isha Chashuva, then the Shultot said then maybe women would lean as well. And last but not least, again, there's more interpretations, but I'll just mention to you a third interpretation. Somebody, the Rabbeinu Manoach, who's a commentator on the Rambam, says, well, really it has to do with, we started off this year with a little bit of a humorous anecdote about how difficult sometimes preparing for the Seder can be for women. So Rabbeinu Manoach, one of his interpretations says, yes, that's exactly it. A typical woman feels like a fishmated by the time she gets to the Seder. The last thing on her mind is, I'm going to be a free woman because I leaned. But says Rabbeinu Manoach, you have certain women who are very wealthy. They have avadim, ushvachot, they had help. Right? You can have help in the house, you can be in a hotel. But if you're not fashmatad when you come to the Seder, why shouldn't you lean? You're feeling just as free as your husband. It's a Metzias question. Right? So there's different interpretations of the Gemara, but what's interesting is how it comes into the Shulchan Aruch. So it comes along the Ramah, who was not a feminist, he wasn't even a proto-feminist, living a few hundred years ago in Krakow, Poland, and says, all of our women nowadays are chashuvos. Tweet that out or whatever people do nowadays. Says the Ramah, all women are chashuvos. Kol anashim shlana mikrei chashuvos. And yet, says the Ramah, the minhag is women don't typically lean. Why? Because the Rav Yah said nowadays there's no point in leaning because no one leans anymore. So of course the obvious question is, it's a catch 22, amanafshah. If no one leans anymore, then why are even the men leaning? It's not clear at all. So I think the easiest answer to this question is actually something that Rav Asher Weiss published in his Haggadah, where he said, listen, probably what it means is, Ikar hadin, really, 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 no one should lean, not men or women. Because probably the Rav Yah was right. But the minhag was always that men lean, so we keep on doing it as a minhag. Not really as a chiv anymore, but more as a minhag. But, says Rav Asher Weiss, probably what it means is, the minhag never was for women to lean. So therefore, there's no reason to do it. If it would be meaningful, there'd be a reason to do it. It was not the minhag, and it's not really meaningful in today's culture. So what would be the point? So the bottom line, from our perspective, is I've known that there are different families where women have different practices. Based on the Ramah, I can't speak for Sephardim, but I don't know if they'd be against it. I'd be surprised. But certainly for Ashkenazi women, any woman who does have the practice of leaning, who wants to lean, there's nothing wrong with it whatsoever. Whether it's really a mitzvah or not is an open question, but there's certainly nothing wrong with it, for sure not. If a woman who doesn't lean, doesn't want to lean, it's not your family custom for women to lean, it's also fine, because that's what the Ramah brings down, that women don't lean. But there's nothing wrong with it whatsoever, and it may even really, really be a mitzvah if that's your minhag. If you want to do it, I have no problem with it, because into hate, but it's a little bit of a gray issue. If you'll indulge me 5 more minutes, I'll just finish very quickly. We'll do the Maror and the Hallel. So Maror is only rabbinic, which is why we say it until the end of the Shir. Maror is only a rabbinic mitzvah, because in the Chumash, it's very connected to Karban Pesach. So without the Karban Pesach, it's like having a sandwich with just the ketchup or just the mustard and none of the meat. Right? Maror is the relish on the steak of the Karban Pesach. Without the Karban Pesach, it's only Dirabana. And we do this to remember the fact that the Egyptians embittered our lives. Women are obligated, unfortunately for you, women are obligated like men in Maror, based on the idea of Av Hein Hayub Osa Hanes. Huge discussion, going back to the Mishnah, what is Maror? And the two most popular candidates are either romaine lettuce or actual, the root of a horseradish. Very, very few people could actually eat enough horseradish in and of itself. So much, much more common, and according to many poskim, preferable, is some kind of romaine lettuce. Romaine lettuce is a little bit bitter. It's not always particularly bitter. I remember my father used to put a lot of chrain in the romaine lettuce. You could do that if you want. That was my father's minhag. But you don't have to do it. You don't have to do it. Already the Yerushalmi says, yeah, we understand that romaine lettuce is not going to like make you start crying and your eyes water. But the idea is, it was like what happened to the Jews in Egypt. Because in the beginning it was good, and then over time embittered. So too says the Yerushalmi when it comes to these kinds of lettuce, you eat a little bit, it's not so bad. But the more you eat, it actually gets more and more bitter. So I don't know if that, how true that is or not, but that's the symbolism the Yerushalmi says of romaine lettuce. How much do you have to eat? So again, we're talking about a kezias, but since it's only rabbinic, we can do a quote-unquote smaller kezaisiv. Kezaisiv. Now, how does that translate into, you know, how do you figure out how much is a kezias? So I'm trusting Rav Rimon on this, and the easiest way that he described it, he thought it's really the leaves, not the stalk, just the stalk itself doesn't really count, but in terms of the leaves, he thought a full leaf of an average size piece of romaine lettuce is enough. Again, not a little piece, not a little bite, not even two little bites. It doesn't have to be the hugest, doesn't have to be five pieces, but a full leaf of an average romaine lettuce, he thought was basically what you would assume to be a kezias. And let's finish up with, very quickly, two more points, afikomen and halal. So we mentioned afikomen previously before, that the word means dessert, and the Korban Pesach used to be, you know, again, I don't know if you envision what the Seder was like back in the day. The main course wasn't the Korban Pesach. We ate dinner, and then al hasova, when we were full, but not too full, dessert was the Korban Pesach. That's my kind of meal. Steak for dessert. Then again, I like regular dessert too. That's my problem. I like all good food. Anyway, so just like the last taste on your mouth when you would go to sleep at night in the time of the Meis HaMikdash was the Korban Pesach. So that's why we say, Eim Aftir Nachar Pesach Afikomen. We have the Afikomen to commemorate either the meat or the matzah that was eaten with the meat. We mentioned that previously. Here's an important point, and I'll give you leverage over your children and grandchildren. So we know we break matzah, we hide it, and the kids and every family's got their minhag with stealing and hiding, all that. So the kids think they have you over the barrel. They don't give you back the matzah. You can't fulfill it. If you worst case scenario, you had lost that matzah, you could fulfill afikomen with any piece of shmura matzah. So you should just let the children know. If they're playing hardball with you, you tell them Rabbi Gottlieb said, I don't even need your matzah. So you're going to take the ping pong table or whatever it is that you're negotiating over with your kids for afikomen. It should be eaten before midnight. That's at a very important point. Midnight meaning halachic midnight, whatever chatzos is. It has to be eaten before that. And it should be the last thing that you eat. If we still have, you know, wine at the Seder, that's okay. And if you needed some water, that's okay. But unless there's a real necessity, a person should not eat or really drink anything else after that. And for this, because some poskim say this might be the real mitzvah of matzah, we do try, I know this is very hard, it's the end of the Seder, and you're exhausted and you're already full, we do try to have the double shear, which I mentioned the different options earlier in the thing, just like for motzi matzah, we do try to have the same amount for afikomen. And last but not least, this is when we're all exhausted and the kids are off the wall, or they're sleeping under the table, or wherever they are, is halal. Again, there was halal with the Korban Pesach back in the day, so we do halal as well. There are a lot of things that are unique and anomalous about the halal of the Seder. It's at night. We never say halal at night. We say halal only once a year at night, and that's at the Seder. We do it sitting. Halal is always done standing. We don't make a bracha. We always start bracha, barucha, you know, across the halal. We don't say a bracha at the Seder. And basically, if you add up all the, and usually during the year, women are not obligated in the halal. Women are obligated. Women are obligated in the halal of the Seder. And you put all the anomalies together, the most common explanation already brought down in the Rishonim is that this halal is different. And it goes back to how we started, and it goes back to a theme we've already mentioned previously in the Shir, which is that usually when we think about halal on Sukkot or other holidays or Pesach, or Hanukkah, I should say, or even during davening the rest of Pesach, we're commemorating an event in the past. At the Seder, we're actually not commemorating, we're reliving. We're in the moment. And we're supposed to, again, I'm not saying it's easy, not even close to being easy, but from a religious, halachic, hashkafic perspective, we're re-experiencing and recreating that, just like that initial thrill, if you're actually saved, that halal, that song, you know, that was not pro forma, that was not cliche, that was not yet another Karlbach davening. It was like, wow, like you're in the moment. That's why, usually we're trying to recreate something or recollect something, so we have different rules for halal. But at the Seder, we're actually re-experiencing it as if we're on the banks of the Yam Suf, and that explains a lot of the different anomalies, including the fact that women are obligated just as much as men. Okay, it should be a wonderful Yom Tov.